Blog Talk Radio.
Pour yourself a cup of tea, put your feet up, and relax. Show host Randy Fine, narcissistic abuse expert, compassionate counselor for clients worldwide, and author of the groundbreaking new book, Close Encounters of the Worst Kind, invites you into her sanctuary, a place where your emotional, physical, and spiritual well-being are all that matters. Time to Heal is a fundraising single written and performed by Johnny Z for the Amy Winehouse Foundation. For more information, please go to johnnymusic.com, johnnymusic.com. And now, it's time to meet Randy, show host of the podcast enjoyed by fans around the globe, A Fine Time for Healing.
Good morning. Thank you for tuning in to listen to A Fine Time for Healing. I am your talk show host, Randy Fine. So I'm going to make a statement and think about this for a second. The aftermath of large-scale tragedy in the United States, whether environmental or as a result of violence, such as mass shootings, often follows a predictable pattern for the public at large. What do you think? Well, I'll tell you, nothing could be farther from the truth. So for the impacted community, where in addition to the grief-stricken victims' friends and families, everyone from the first responders and doctors to the local clergy and area leaders are thrown into uncharted territory. In healing a community, lessons for recovery after a large-scale trauma, today's special guest, Melissa Glazer, MSLPC, the director of the Newtown Recovery and Resiliency Team, and one of the country's preeminent community response and recovery leaders, offers a practical and much-needed guide for local officials, emergency workers, mental health professionals, and anyone dealing with the daunting task of supporting and healing a community after tragedy and trauma. Melissa Glazer is a licensed professional counselor who's been providing clinical psychotherapy services for the past 28 years. While maintaining a private practice, Melissa has held an array of positions in the field of psychology, including several clinical leadership positions in nonprofit organizations, as well as other things. So I want you to meet this special guest so we can get started, and I'll introduce you. Good morning, Melissa. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. This is such an important topic for us all to talk about.
It absolutely is. We've all witnessed these things, whether in our community or on television, or, you know, we've all heard about this, and everyone is shocked when it happens. So as the director of the Newtown Recovery and Resiliency Team, you were tasked with creating a response to the consequences of the Sandy Hook school shooting.
Correct.
What is your background, and what prepared you for this task?
Yeah. So as you said in your introduction, I am a licensed professional counselor. I have many, many years of clinical experience. So working firsthand with people experiencing clinical struggles and challenges, as well as leadership positions in nonprofits and other community-based organizations. So I think the combination of those two facets of my career made me well suited for the position to coordinate the recovery and resiliency team and response in Sandy Hook after the shooting. However, you know, as I write in my book, I had no idea what I was going to be stepping into, and certainly there was no roadmap to guide me or to guide our team through the process. So even with that array of experience, you know, I really had to rebuild, start from the ground up, and, you know, figure out gaps and needs and assess the whole community.
I can't even imagine how broad, and reading your book was just such an eye-opener for me, because I was amazed at how far-reaching and how many people were touched and how many people are relying on the support system. What kind of physical and technological infrastructure is needed to support recovery in the community?
Yeah. So, you know, some of the more concrete physical structure that most people might think about in have to do with creating a space, an environment where anyone in a community impacted by these tragedies will have access to care and access to coordinated resources. So, you know, on the very basic level, it's about building that site and then bringing together the right professionals as a team. But then on a larger scale, so, you know, we did that, and we provided individual care coordination on a very comprehensive way to, in the 18 months we were there, to more than 900 individuals in the community. But I also knew that it was going to be important for us to create, develop, and provide large-scale programming for subsets of the community that could be sustained long after we were in place. So that might be, we put together a year-long recovery program for the first responders. We did a comprehensive program for the teachers that were present during the shooting. We worked with clinicians who were feeling, you know, that they were experiencing some vicarious traumatization and needed some help themselves. Pediatricians that were seeing a lot of these children that were impacted, and many more examples of that are in my book. So it's also thinking on the larger scale and figuring out, you know, what are the pieces, what are the components that you have to create for that. You know, interestingly, when I stepped into the work, it was to oversee a large federal grant that the Department of Justice had awarded the community. And it was the first of its kind to address the emotional impact of an entire community. But very interestingly, the time frame for the work was 18 months, because I really believe that was the general consensus of how long it would take to get a community to heal. And, you know, I write about this, that, you know, I, you know, knew after a year of the work that this is just the infancy stages. We're just touching the surface.
Amazing.
That recovery of a community is 10 to 15 years out. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. How difficult is it for a community to come together to work through something as shocking and traumatic as the Sandy Hook school
yeah.
shooting or the Stoneman Douglas school shooting or any of the other ones? How difficult is that?
Sure. You know, I think each community has its own dynamics and nuances that help to dictate that. Newtown at the time, you know, there were such amazing efforts on behalf of individuals and neighbors and, you know, governing professionals to try to bring people together. However, there were also lots of divides that come with any of these tragedies, a lot of political divides, even though there was a lot of money that filtered into the town. Money sometimes creates more issues and can divide individuals and families even further. So, you know, there's all kinds of nuances. I think Department of Justice now, you know, these kinds of grants are more routine to communities, and hopefully they can start the work quickly. One of my criticisms of the grant is that it wasn't written with any sort of clinical lens. There were not clinicians that were part of the writing. So there were, in my opinion, lots of areas that were not addressing trauma and the wide-reaching impact and the emotional needs in a very astute way. But hopefully now that has changed. But when that doesn't happen, when it's not in place and people aren't educated about that, that can help further divides as well.
Sounds like a really, you know, it must be so stressful to work in this. During the crisis phase, so the initial phase, what were the groups of individuals that were identified as likely to require mental health services, other than the obvious? I mean, we know the teachers and students, but who were some of the individuals that needed the mental health services initially?
Yeah, you know, certainly those families that lost a loved one, and their immediate families, as well as, you know, family members that, you know, grandparents and cousins, and, you know, we saw a lot of that. I was always amazed almost every day somebody else would come into our center and identify themselves as being impacted, and it, you know, was somebody that you would not have thought of. So, you know, for us, and again, every tragedy has its own dynamics, but it was the bus drivers, you know, that felt guilty because maybe they were thinking, well, I drove that child or those children to their death that day. It was, you know, the person that was the grave digger that, you know, I dug three graves this weekend. It was the soccer coach. It was the teenager that babysat for a child that's no longer here. You know, it's the person that the trainer at the gym that, you know, is having parents that they've worked with come in and flooded with emotions and they don't know how to handle it or can't fix it. You know, so every time we turned around, it seemed that somebody else was revealing themselves. The neighbor, you know, who had a child that was the same age and in a different classroom than the one where there were no children that survived. And, you know, now our kids used to play together and my child came home and yours didn't. So how do I face you? The human resource director in town, you know, who would say, I can't go to sleep at night unless I recount every name of every child that was lost. And if I can't remember, I have to get up and look at my list. So, you know, again, very far reaching.
Yes. I mean, you know, we wouldn't normally think, I mean, we would think about family, extended family, but, you know, the others, yeah, nobody really thinks about that. But you're right. I could see where so many people would be affected by this and hurt by this. So you say that 4 years is still the infancy stage for recovery from massive trauma. So now we're talking about the individual. So how long does it really take, if there is an answer to that, for someone who has had this experience, this massive trauma, to heal?
Yeah, you know, the interesting and difficult component of trauma is that everybody is in a different place and heals on a different time frame. And some of that has to do with where they were in their life before the tragedy. You know, what supports did they have in place? You know, how positive were they looking at their life? Was, you know, their marriage intact before, or was it struggling before? And if they were struggling, then after the tragedy, then, you know, the pieces that were holding them together might really start to unravel in a big way. Did somebody have a substance abuse issue before the tragedy and now it's full blown? You know, was somebody, you know, using unhealthy means to get through their day or to function, and now that has gotten out of control? So everybody is in a different place, and you have to meet each individual where they are at and craft a program or a plan for them that really speaks to what their needs are. We developed, I had a team of three care coordinators, and they did a comprehensive high-level care coordinating process where they really held each person's hand to get them on, you know, in the right momentum, to get them to make those next steps. And they crafted a plan for each person that walked in based on what their needs were.
Incredible.
So time frames, yeah, and time frames are tough. Some people, you know, reach that place of resilience within a year or 18 months, and some people are still kind of, you know, eking by. And then the other factor in all of this is triggering, re-triggering. So somebody can be doing really well, and then all of a sudden there's a lockdown drill in the school, and it sets them back to that day. Or they have another loss in their life and really take 10 steps backwards. Or, you know, they hear a police chase or an ambulance drive by, and all of a sudden they find themselves in a state of complete dysregulation. So it doesn't, you know, there's no clear directory or trajectory on how trauma recovery works. So for some people, you know, it can be, again, a year, 18 months, and some people 10 years out, you know, they're still challenged and struggling with this in an acute way.
Right.
Yeah.
So talking about triggering, how did the community respond to the Netflix documentary? Was that mm-hmm. something that they wanted, or did it open wounds, reopen the wounds?
Yeah. What I experienced was not just that documentary, but anybody writing about the tragedy, any other, there was a wonderful film that PBS sponsored from Behind the Lens that came out, and that producer worked extremely closely with a lot of community members and a lot of families that lost children. But what I found was, no matter what, there was always differing opinions and divides. You know, I really came to feel that any meeting I was present at where I was addressing an issue or bringing up a need that had to be looked at, that there was always going to be, you know, two people that embraced what I had to say and liked it, and two people that didn't and would express anger and pain and fear, no matter what it was. So, you know, in this, I think, happens in most communities, whether it's, you know, erecting a memorial or, you know, do we in the yearbook, you know, memorialize the children that were lost, or what do we do with this money that was donated for this purpose? You know, how much is enough? How do we set boundaries around that? It didn't matter. There were always differing opinions and divides.
Yeah, and I guess that's with everything. You say that recovery and resilience is not a return to how you felt before the incident. So is it a new normal or a new existence that people come to eventually?
Yeah, I term recovery and resilience as two different things. Resilience is that end of the recovery path, and more of kind of post-traumatic growth. Recovery is quite a journey to get there. And, you know, the journey is, it starts off with how do I find a way to function through my pain and my new sense of normal, which might include a lot of distrust and a lot of anger and a lot of isolation. You know, my faith being broken. So it starts there and is a process, again, very individualized. And hopefully if an individual can stay on that journey, they find that their ability to function, although always going to be different than it was before, that their ability to function and create a life that can be fulfilling again, can be a quality life, gets easier and easier. And then you get to resilience.
Yeah, I would imagine guilt is a huge part of it. Recovering.
Guilt is very present for most people that are traumatized in one form or another. Survivor's guilt is what we call it. That came up quite a bit. So, you know, we hope that we can get someone to a place of resilience, which I say is kind of when you can walk the walk, you know, talk the talk, that you're doing so well with your recovery that you can help your friend and your neighbor and your coworker find what they need to.
Does it help for people to reframe this in a way that makes it either advocates for change or helpers for other people? Is that something that, because I know with stress and trauma, a lot of times reframing into a different way can sometimes help accelerate the process. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it always helps. It has to be done at the right time for each person that is grieving and feeling the trauma. But if we don't reframe, right, then we're either leaving ourselves in a state of perpetual confusion and asking questions we'll never get answers to. You know, why, how could this have happened? Why did it impact my family or my loved one? And we'll never have answers to that. So reframing may allow us, you know, some relief to, okay, you know, this is what landed in my life, in my family. This is, a piece now of our legacy that we have to figure out how to live through.
So post-traumatic stress often results in, this is what you say, cognitive and behavioral changes and deficits and emotional flooding transfers into the breakdown in cognitive processing. So what are some of the brain changes that take place? And I know there's also sort of a rewiring that takes place. So I'd love for you to talk about that.
Yeah, you know, the research that is being done now is amazingly constantly coming out with, new thoughts and ideas and, you know, through brain mapping and mind-body techniques, you know, we're getting much more insight about what happens. You know, we know that somebody that experiences post-traumatic stress, their brain is absolutely physically changed. You know, those neural pathways are different. When we map somebody's brain that has experienced PTSD or is experiencing that versus someone that isn't, it looks very different. And there are places that light up in, you know, parts of our brain that are rooted in emotion and behavior that have now been forever damaged. And we act differently to sights, to sounds, to a sense of trust, and to how emotion evolves. So it's really much more now, even 6 years since I was working at Sandy Hook, there are people that are doing fascinating work in that area. And we have medications now that we know can make a big impact. We have mind-body strategies and techniques that we know, and we understand the supports and resources that are needed and the time frame that's needed to help individuals that have PTSD.
You also say that your team learned that the impact on the brain is such that even the individual's capacity for self-awareness is affected. And, you know, you say that those around them may see these changes in personality and behavior, but the person is unaware of the transformation. So what might that look like?
Yeah, so I think we would have people that came in and didn't have the language to tell us what they were feeling, but they would say, I'm not the same, or things are terribly wrong in my life now, but I can't tell you what it is. And as we would kind of help to ground them and educate, we would hear things like, I'm in a constant brain fog. I can't organize. I'm overthinking everything. The things that used to come so easy now just become utterly confusing, and I can't find my way out of it. So, you know, it's not just the things that we see maybe on television or in the movies where, you know, there's a loud noise and somebody is looking stunned or behaving in a way that, you know, they're jumpy or acting irrational. It's a lot of subtle things, you know, isolating more, feeling depressed just enough to not know why, but not be able to find joy in life anymore. So, you know, when you're experiencing some of these subtle things, you may not put it all together and be able to say, huh, this is because of what I experienced. So we would educate a lot, and I think that's a huge component of recovery work, helping people to find the language. It was amazing to me how many individuals, when we talked about what this looks like, would show immediate relief and say things like, oh my God, that's why I feel the way I do. Or
right.
If somebody had just explained that to me earlier, I would have been a little bit easier on myself, or I would have been able to say, you know, this is my new anxiety. This is my this is coming from my place of trauma, and please bear with me, or please understand why I feel like I'm always on the verge of tears, or always jumping out of my skin, or always in a bit of a fog and look like I'm dissociating.
Yeah, I mean, anytime we don't understand why we're feeling the way we're feeling, it's very stressful.
Yes.
You know, so yes. You say that.
And I'm sitting in my office with individuals. An individual, they will often, you know, come in and describe symptoms and say, I have no idea, you know, why am I feeling so anxious? You know, why all of a sudden do I feel like everything is doom and gloom? And very quickly, we can unpack that and easily see the connection to a place of trauma that has been re-triggered. So, education is really important in all of this.
Okay, so you say that no two people experience the same path to recovery and that there may be disruption of the personality, the sense of safety, the life perspective, the lifestyle. Is it possible for someone to heal themselves without professional help after a large-scale trauma?
Yeah, I think if people that are very good at that are the people that are extremely open to expressing that they need help, accepting the help that might be there in terms of creating their own pathway for that, and, you know, that find natural strategies that help ground them. So, you know, one of the phenomena, and again, I talk about it in the book, is I'm a trained cognitive behavioral therapist, and I went into Newtown believing that that would be the foundation of a lot of the work that we were doing. And I was mistaken, because what I encountered was a lot of people that were so dysregulated that you couldn't do cognitive behavioral work. You know, they couldn't absorb any of that until they got grounded again. And in order to ground someone, you need to use all kinds of mind-body techniques that are much more hands-on and not just talk therapy. So people that heal themselves, I think, would be, someone that may naturally realize that in order to ground themselves, maybe they need to take a long run every morning and start their day with some rhythm to clear their head and allow, you know, that mind-body connection to take place in a more natural way. Or someone that is experiencing a lot of continual tension and fear might realize that maybe acupuncture would work to release some of that tension. So absolutely, it doesn't necessarily take a professional to be there every step of the way. But I do think, you know, with this level of professionals that are well-versed in the clinical resources makes a huge difference.
Yeah, I agree. It's interesting mm-hmm. that you brought up the cognitive behavioral therapy approach, because I work with people who have suffered long-term emotional abuse, psychological abuse mm-hmm. from, narcissistic people with a personality disorder.
Right.
And often, the first thing that they do is they go to a therapist, and the therapist uses cognitive behavioral therapy on them. Well, that doesn't work in this situation either, because they have no responsibility. They cannot see a part in this at all. They are victims. They are strictly victims. And they end up getting worse sometimes. These are people who have complex PTSD, years of childhood abuse, those kind of things. They need to understand first and foremost that they were victims of the situation. They have no responsibility. And once you lift up the guilt and allow them to understand that, it releases so much from them.
Yeah.
I didn't want to laugh.
And I think part of that is like the education piece, you know. So when you're mm-hmm. treating someone that's a victim of a narcissist, it's so important to teach them about what narcissism is and why a narcissist
right.
operates the way they do. And,
yeah.
you know, that it had nothing to do with how the victim behaved or didn't behave, unless
right.
they were going to comply and go along with everything the narcissist wanted them to do.
Exactly.
So it's so important to provide that level of education so that the individual can then see themselves as, you know, I somehow attached myself to somebody that was really sick.
Yes.
And I became a victim of that sickness. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and
absolutely.
Same thing with trauma. Yeah.
Right. So how would someone? Well, let's skip over that. Mm-hmm. How can we as the public help if something occurs in our community? What is something that everyone can do without affecting the the process that's been put in place?
Yeah, I think what everybody can do is not try hard not to be afraid of reaching out to somebody that you can see is clearly impacted in some way, and not to feel like if you ask them or bring it up that it's going to hurt them more, and not to feel like the awkwardness of addressing someone or bringing attention to what they may be going through is too difficult to do. So it's always good to reach out. There are people that are easy to reach out to because they're able to express what they need and what they feel, but there are a lot of people that aren't. There are a lot of people that you may know have just become quiet or are just saying no to invitations or seeming to be drinking a little bit more or seeming to be irritated at everything lately. And so what everybody can do is when you notice that, don't shy away from it, but, don't lean back, but lean in, in a gentle way. And you're not supposed to have the answers, but, lending a hand or helping someone to get to the right place for the right resources can be tremendous.
What about contributions, financial contributions?
Yeah, I was going to say in a concrete way. So, Newtown was flooded with well-meaning donations of all kinds of things that were not only difficult to manage, but ended up really not being useful at all. And, after, still a year after the tragedy, Newtown had to rent a warehouse to house, blankets and teddy bears and craft supplies and gift cards and, a warehouse full because so much flooded into town. There was no place to put it. And really, it wasn't useful. So those are the kinds of things that I would definitely say, don't put your energy or money into. Recovery is an expensive process, so many people that need the help may not have insurance, or they have insurance with high deductibles, and making a donation to the right entity can help, serve people that need some financial assistance to get the help they need, so that is much more worthwhile.
Okay, so targeting, targeting a specific need or specific person,
yes,
or whatever that is in need. Okay, good.
Oftentimes in the community there is a foundation that is established that may be the central place where donations like that are collected. So
okay.
It's good to figure out who and where that is.
Okay, great. Your book is an amazing roadmap for every community, and I'm wondering how many communities have called, if anyone has called on you for your help in building their infrastructure, if something like this has happened. I figure that this is what you want to do with this book, is you want everyone to have it, so they will know how to do this. But have you been called on to do this in other communities?
I have. Spent some time in Orlando after the nightclub shooting to help them. I recently got a call from Virginia Beach for some guidance. And, was at the American Counseling Association a couple of months ago and working with some of the Parkland teachers and staff on looking ahead at some of their responses and what the future needs would be. So, yeah, my whole reason for writing this was because I really didn't have a roadmap myself, and I wanted the lessons that we learned and, you know, some of the really the work that I'm really proud of, you know, by our team to help others. And most of what's in the book is pretty transferable to any community. Little did I know when I wrote it that we would have so many ongoing tragedies, which is really, you know, speaks to a few other topics about gun control and mental health issues. But you know, that was my reasoning. I didn't want the work that we did to die, you know, when we left the community and when the grant ended. So I hope, you know, the book just came out in February. So, you know, I'm hoping that I will hear more from other communities that, you know, certainly are just picking it up and looking for guidance and, you know, want to talk about next steps.
That's excellent. Well, it is an excellent book. And so we're talking about your book, Healing a Community, Lessons for Recovery After a Large-Scale Trauma. And this book, I would imagine, is available on Amazon and such.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it
correct?
Is. Absolutely. Okay. Central Recovery Press is the publisher, and you can get it through their website or certainly on Amazon, yes.
Okay, great. And do you have a website, should anyone want to reach you directly, or an email you want to share?
Yeah, so my website is melissaglaser, GLASER.com. And I am always, you know, happy to speak to anyone by phone, provide any guidance, you know, to hands-on or remotely. And if there's any issues or topics that people are thinking about that, you know, they feel like they want to open up a wider audience to, I'd be happy to hear about that. So, again, it's Melissa,
perfect.
M-E-L-I-S-S-A, glazer.com.
Okay, perfect. Thank you, Melissa. Thank you for the work you do. Thank you for this book.
Thank you for having me.
Because I know you put a lot into this book. There's so much here. And you've been a marvelous guest. I appreciate it so much.
Well, again, thank you for having me on your show, on your podcast, and happy to, you know, open up this really important work and topic to others.
Excellent. Well, you did. And when people pick up a copy of this book, they will learn even more. And then the more people that read it, the more people will be available to help or offer at least your roadmap to the right people who can help. So I thank you again. Have a wonderful day.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Take
we
care.
Are out of time today. Yes, you too. We are out of time today. But if you have any comments or questions about today's show, you can email me at loveyourlife@randyfine.com. May joy and serenity always be yours. Goodbye.
We hope you enjoyed today's programming. To learn more about Randy Fine, read her articles, or to make a counseling appointment with her, please visit randygfine.com. That's RANDIGFINE.com. Or visit her on Facebook at Randy G. Fine.